session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Okay, before I call our first case, we have a little different lineup, and I want to go over it with counsel to be sure we're all on the same page. So if what I tell you is not your understanding, do let me know right away. We're going to start out with Attorney Leroy for 25 minutes, okay, and then Attorney Skilton for 20 minutes, Attorney Greer for 10 minutes, and then back to rebuttal with Attorney Leroy. All right. Are you prepared to proceed? Please.
May it please the court. Deputy Solicitor General Kevin Leroy, on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources.
Sir, would you be kind enough to pull that microphone?
Certainly.
Thank you.
So, as the appellant in the underlying case, DNR has the right under Section 752.21.2 to select the Court of Appeals district to hear its appeal. We selected District 2, but District 4 violated our selection rights by removing the case from District 2's docket and placing it on its own. And only a supervisory writ from this court can remedy that violation.
Talk to me about how you meet the elements of a supervisory writ.
Yes, Your Honor. So the elements of the supervisory writ are, first, that an appeal is inadequate. Second, that there's a violation of a plain duty. Third, that there's irreparable harm. And fourth, that it was filed promptly. So prompt is out of the picture because the other side has conceded that we filed promptly. The violation of the plain duty, that's essentially a violation of the law. So that's what we allege, that they violated the appellate venue selection rights by removing the case from District 2's docket and placing it on its own.
How plain must the legal duty be? Is there a standard that's been specified anywhere in the law for what the plain legal duty, how plain must the duty be?
So, Your Honor, as I interpret this Court's cases, plain is best understood as the opposite of a discretionary duty. So a violation of the law may be a violation of the plain duty. I don't think all legal violations are violations of plain duty that a supervisory writ may remedy. So, for example, the Kalal case mentions just simply not finding the correct law wouldn't justify a supervisory writ. But here, when we have a venue statutes that govern the rest of the proceedings, and then that cannot be remedied, as kind of blending into the first, and it cannot be remedied through the ordinary course of appeal, that should qualify as a plain duty.
I think here we have parties, though, arguing vehemently two different statutory constructions. We have three different statutory sections at play. So one could read the arguments and reasonably conclude that the duty really isn't plain, that this is a very complicated statutory construction.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that's what plain means here. I think it really does mean a mandatory legal requirement. And so the venue statutes that we have put forward to the court here, they aren't discretionary, unlike 801.52, which has a discretionary change of venue.
Well, the John Doe opinions indicate that it has to be readily interpreted and readily applied. That's not the exact language that's used in the John Doe cases or other cases, but it's very close to that. And once you have to have an interpretation of the statute and a fight about its application to these particular facts, it's not plain, it's not discretionary, it's an interpretation of the law, but it's not one that hits you in the face and says, you got to do it. The court has to do it. Now, I have a different question for you, if I can just move from what plain duty is, but that's the main argument in the briefs of the four requirements for a supervisory writ, most time is spent on plain duty, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, this could have been done in a different way. The chief judge of the Court of Appeals could have said that District 2 is on overload and that it stays in District 2, but he's assigning the judges from District 1, from District 4 to handle these cases. That's done with some frequency. It's done from some frequency of where the Court of Appeals in District 1 would ordinarily handle the case, but the judges from a different district, whether it's 3 or 4 or something else, take the case. So you get the same result. You don't have a choice of what judges hear the case. You have a choice of what on the top of the caption is the district number, but not who is going to sit on that case. They could have assigned 3 reserve judges, right?
They may well have been able to assign 3 reserve judges, and whether...
The district board judges.
I'm sorry?
Or district four judges.
They may have been able to assign district four judges. However, the statute does say that the appellant has the right to select the Court of Appeals district. The issue of...
It's form over substance. The substance is you're not entitled to any 3 judges. You're entitled only to judges from the Court of Appeals or reserve judges assigned to the Court of Appeals, not particular judges.
So, Your Honor, I did look at very briefly. It's not in the briefing, but the authority of the the courts of appeals to transfer judges
right.
to handle
mm-hmm.
workload. And I couldn't actually find where that authority would be listed. And now in the Constitution, the legislature has the right to define the districts of the Court of Appeals
mm-hmm.
and the right to determine the appellate venue. So in perfect candor, that procedure may very well violate another statutory provision or the legislature's authority. However, here, we didn't have the Court of Appeals, the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, transferring judges.
I understand that, but the effect is the same.
The effect might be the same. However, if the effect is still an unlawful effect, I think we would be back here and it's the same supervisory writ. Now, a transfer didn't happen here. What happened here is that District 4 took the case from District 2's docket and placed it on its own. And to Your Honor's first point about a violation of the plain duty, I think these statutes are readily applied. And I'd like to go through them if possible. So Section 801...
I'm happy that you're getting back to my initial question, but... Let me just stop for a moment and put on the brakes. If there's a violation of a plain duty, is there any authority for a harmless error analysis to apply to that?
I'm not certain if the court has defined a harmless error analysis, particularly in the supervisory writ procedures. However, I think it would be appropriate to do that in a supervisory writ procedure, but really what that would mean is that the harm is not irreparable. So I suppose in that way, looking at it in that way, you would say there is a harmless error analysis baked into the elements of the supervisory writ. And here, though, we have a legislatively granted right to select appellate venue. And that right has been completely extinguished by the Court of Appeals for District 4. So that is a harm to DNR. And
your harm, as you stated, is that you have agreed to name the district. You agree you don't have the name, you do not have the right to name the judges who are going to hear the case, right?
Your Honor, my position is that we have the right to have judges from District 2 hear this case under the ordinary procedures that those judges are assigned to hear these cases.
And so you don't think that 3 reserve judges could be appointed, or 2 judges from another district, and et cetera. You just are challenging that. You are always entitled to those judges elected in District 2.
I think that phraseology is too broad. I think what we're entitled to is to have judges who are lawfully appointed to District 2 through lawful procedures hear this case. So if transfer of judges from one district to another is lawful. And again, this isn't in the briefing, but I was not able to find a procedure that has authorized the court to do that.
And you know what, counsel? If a questioner wanted to, a questioner could eat up all of your time and then some by asking about various hypotheticals which have absolutely nothing to do with this case. I want to bring you back to the facts of this case. And I would like you to address your argument to the genesis, to the basis of what you argue is the plain legal duty. And as I see it, it has to do with the substantive law which allows the one party to pick the circuit court where they're going to file, where they have a choice, and the party who does not prevail in that circuit court to pick any other court of appeals other than the court of appeals where the circuit court lies, where they lost the case. And I would like you, I think I've sketched out accurately so far as I've gone, but I think that's where your argument in this case, having to do with the facts of this case, bearing on the arguments in this case, come from. And I think I would find it, and perhaps other members of the bench would find it, most helpful for you to address how you arrive at the conclusion that there was a plain legal duty based on the facts and the law in this case.
Yes, Your Honor, happy to. So this case turns on the meaning of designated in subsection 801.50(3)(a) and section 752.21 sub 2. So 801.50(3)(a) governs circuit court venue, and that provision reads, except as provided in paragraphs B and C, all actions in which the sole defendant is the state shall be venued in the county designated by the plaintiff unless another venue is specifically authorized by law. So I have three comments about this statute. First is designate means to indicate or specify. So a designation occurs when the plaintiff indicates the circuit court venue by filing. And this occurs in all actions solely against the state, except those that fall under the express exceptions, paragraphs B and C, right in the statute. So my second comment is that other venue provisions apply along with 801.50(3)(a). So provisions like those found in subsection 227.53(1)(a)(3), which does apply in this case, they simply limit the scope of eligible designations for the plaintiff to make. And my third comment is that the clause reading, unless another venue is specifically authorized by law, that contemplates cases moving from the designated venue to another venue. So this means the designated venue may not be the actual venue of judgment in a given case. And that has significant implications for appellate venue selection rights. So those rights are governed by section 752.21(2). That statute reads, a judgment or order appealed from an action venued in a county designated by the plaintiff as provided under section 801.50(3)(a) shall be heard in the Court of Appeals district selected by the appellant. So to apply this to statutory framework here, DNR had appellate venue selection rights because Clean Wisconsin designated Dane County as the venue. That venue decided the case against DNR. DNR then selected District 2 to hear the appeal.
What about the argument from your opposing counsel in brief that Clean Wisconsin had no choice and therefore it wasn't a designation, but there was no choice but to bring it in Dane County? That's what they argue in their briefs, and I want to hear your response.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. So they argue that designate in 801.50(3)(a) means to select, as in having the unfettered choice of venue. So they claim a plaintiff only designates venue under 801.50(3)(a) when they have the unfettered choice, when no other venue provisions in the entire Wisconsin statutes may affect their venue selection. And then they further argue that the clause that reads, unless another venue is specifically authorized by law, they say that operates as an exception to designation, meaning they didn't have their choice. And so when they have other venue statutes, like here, those venue statutes specifically authorize another venue, which means no designation ever occurred, and therefore we don't get appellate.
Well, that left me with a question, and maybe you can answer it. Why couldn't they have filed it in Kewaunee?
So I think Clean Wisconsin could have filed in Kewaunee. They have 20,000 members statewide, and so they can presumably file on behalf of their members or file on behalf of themselves. Excuse me. And so this really gets into one of the flaws. I think there's four flaws with their interpretation. One of those is it misstates the purposes of the statutes. So they claim the purpose is to have a trade-off of forum selection rights. So the trade-off of forum selection, so they claim it's a trade-off of forum selection, so you have the plaintiff selecting forum shopping in the district, the circuit court, you have the appellant selecting forum shopping in the Court of Appeals. But this trade-off purpose cannot possibly be the purpose of 801.53a, because that section says it's the plaintiff's designation, and then 752
Why would it rest on where the people in the membership of Clean Wisconsin lies? The controversy itself is taking place on a dairy production facility located in Kewaunee. So wouldn't that be a natural place for venue?
It's certainly a natural place, and it was the natural place for the five individual petitioners suing on behalf of themselves in this case. But Clean Wisconsin, in order to sue DNR over this permit dispute, has to comply with Section 227.5.3, sub 1, sub A, sub 3. And that says they have to file suit where they reside.
Okay.
So they chose to sue on their own behalf. It's captioned Clean Wisconsin. They are a citizen of Dane County. They're incorporated and operate in Dane County.
Got it.
They could have sued on behalf of one of their 20,000 members who presumably live in any county across the state. And in that sense, they could have had this sort of selection rights that they claim to have by virtue of the statute.
Counsel, can you help me out with the difference between in 801 sub 50.50 sub 3 sub A, the difference between county designated by the plaintiff and what follows, unless another venue is specifically authorized by law. And I'd like you to address that in particular in relation to Section 227.53, sub 1, sub A, sub 3, the last sentence, which says if two or more petitions for review of the same decision are filed in different counties, the circuit judge for the county in which a petition for review of the decision was first filed shall determine the venue for judicial review of the decision and shall order transfer or consolidation where appropriate. My understanding is that there were two petitions and that, therefore, it was the responsibility of the judge in Dane County to determine the venue for judicial review. Should we or should we not consider that sentence as being within the meaning of 801.50 sub 3 sub A, another venue specifically authorized by law?
The court should not consider that to be another venue specifically authorized by law, and here's why. A designation occurs in every case solely against the state, except those that fall within the two express exceptions. So a designation occurred twice here, once with Clean Wisconsin designating Dane County, once with the five individual petitioners designating Kewaunee County. Then, pursuant to the sentence that Your Honor had mentioned, the judge from Dane County determined which designation will be given effect. And he did that by consolidating the Kewaunee County case into the Dane County, the Clean Wisconsin's case. So now we have one case. The five individual petitioners' case goes away for venue purposes. And so all the statute is saying in the 227 phrase Your Honor mentioned is which designation will carry the day. Now, the unless another venue is specifically authorized by law, we interpret that to mean that a case may transfer from a designated venue to another venue. And that could happen for a variety of reasons. There's 801.52. There's a venue provision for disqualifying judges. And there's other venue transfer provisions throughout the Wisconsin statutes, including in 227.53. So if that happens, if the case does transfer from the designated venue to another venue, so for instance, if this case transferred from Dane County perhaps back to Kewaunee County after it was consolidated, or perhaps to Milwaukee County, then I don't think we would have appellate venue selection rights, because that statute says you only get those rights when the action has been decided by the venue designated.
So if the Dane County Circuit Court judge had decided that this should be heard in Kewaunee County and consolidated the Dane County action into the Kewaunee County action, your position would then be that the petitioner's designation would have been Kewaunee County. That's the operative designation. Now, upon appeal, you would have the right to designate the district, but then it couldn't be district whatever that that would be.
Yes, that's right. If Clean Wisconsin's case was consolidated into the five individual petitioners' case, such that that case is now our operative case, changes our captions, changes the case number, then yes, we would then get appellate venue selection rights after we presumably would have lost that case as well. An important point is that the formalities, sometimes formalities matter a great deal in the law, and they do matter when the legislature sets out a very particular venue statute framework with very particular steps. So if something happened like the case got, the individual petitioner's case got consolidated into Clean Wisconsin's case, but then the judge said, but I'm going to keep it in Kewaunee County, then what we would have is a case where Clean Wisconsin's case is the lead case, yet not in their designated county, and that the outcome would have been completely different. And the reason why is because the statutes dictate that outcome. Whether or not that's rational or irrational, the fact is that the legislature has prescribed a procedure. Orderly procedures are helpful in the law. Clear rules matter. And so we should follow that procedure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. You finish.
So as I said, I think there are four reasons.
Okay, but then I'm going to ask you this. You are, it's my understanding that in the Dane County Circuit Court, your position was different than it is here. Your position at the Circuit Court was that the Dane County Circuit Court could determine what the which circuit court would handle the case.
Yes, that's correct. And that's
now your position here is that Clean Lakes, Clean Wisconsin determined which court. That wasn't your position before.
No, I don't think that's entirely accurate.
Okay.
Our position
tell me what your position was in Dane County. Your position was, as I understand it, that the Dane County Court could, under the 227.53.1A3, the Circuit Court for the county where the petition was first filed determines the venue. That was your position, and that was authorized. Here you're saying because Clean Wisconsin made a decision, made a determination, designated, you got a right of selection.
Yes, that's right. I think the positions are perfectly consistent. Our position is that a designation occurs when you file in the county, when you indicate the county in your filings, and that when you have under 227, this provision where you have competing filings, it is the circuit court that decides which of those filings will be given effect, which will become the lead case. I think that's perfectly consistent. I don't think the judge's decision which filing will be the lead filing somehow obviates the designation that already occurred.
Well, the Court of Appeals indicated in its decision when it insisted it keep the case, and that's at page 78 of your appendix, that the meaning was unilateral. That is, that Clean Wisconsin didn't have a unilateral sole decision in designating the appropriate circuit court.
That's
and
correct.
Therefore, under the statute, the circuit court had that, and therefore it never had a choice. It didn't have a choice.
Right.
And you don't have a choice.
So that's the Court of Appeals position, and that's incorrect. And the reason why is that they say it means selected. They say their right is to select, but their right is not to select. Their right is to designate. And so we know that designate does not mean select because
well, one of the definitions of designate is select.
Yes, that's correct. And we know it doesn't mean that here, though, because 752.21(2) uses designated and selected separately and in the same sentence. And where the legislature uses similar but different terms, the court may presume different meanings are intended. And because there is a cogent alternative meaning that complies with that canon of construction, specifically DNR's presentation here, that interpretation has to be correct. So that's the first reason why they're wrong.
Doesn't have to be. That's just a rule of interpretation. It is not a required one. It is not necessary that it always be done that way. That is just a helpful rule for the courts to follow, but they need not.
It's certainly a helpful rule, but I think it can be a determinative rule when there is a cogent explanation for why the legislature chose those two different words. The court can't just circumvent the legislature's choice when two different words have different meanings and it creates a cogent statutory
scheme. Except the statutory history in the various fiscal notes don't indicate that you are correct, that that choice words leads to your results.
There's two pieces of statutory history. One, I think, is completely consistent with ours. It simply just parrots the statute. The second one is the fiscal estimate, and I don't think that should be followed. For one, the primary reason is because this statute is not ambiguous when viewed within the statutory structure. So designate has two permissible meanings, but you then go to statutory structure, and you know it can't possibly mean selected because of 752.21 sub 2. And so the fiscal estimate just simply, it doesn't contend with that problem, so I think the court should just put that aside. So my second reason why they're wrong is because they misstate the purpose. My third reason their interpretation is incorrect is because it renders the express exceptions superfluous.
I'd Counsel, like their interpretation is incorrect. Those words catch my mind, and I return to where these oral arguments began with the question about what is plain duty, and the Kalal decision. And the Kalal decision says, and this is a decision since 2004 when it was decided, has probably been cited as authority more than any other case, or certainly among the most cited.
Yes.
And so we sometimes, as I say, bow at the altar or genuflect at the altar of Kalal. Here's a Kalal statement. Just because the judge got the law wrong doesn't mean that he violated or she violated a plain duty. And what is a plain duty? That was the first question that was asked. Kalal answers the question. It must be clear and unequivocal, and under the facts, the responsibility to act must be imperative. So I'm caught on the problem of differing interpretations. And just what that first question was, that I didn't find a satisfactory answer. With those differing interpretations, it doesn't seem so clear and unequivocal. And even if they made a mistake of law, that's not a violation of plain duty. Would you respond to that when you have your opportunity to come
back?
Yes,
certainly.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Rogensack, members of the Court. John Skilton is my name. I'm a law firm of Perkins Coie. I have the honor of representing the Fourth Circuit, Fourth District of the Court of Appeals in this extraordinary writ case. A number of the questions have been addressed to the propriety of bringing the writ in the first instance. My views are stated in the brief. Since it is a matter of discretion that has a lot of factors weighing in, I would prefer to go to the question of plain duty, really to go to the question that Justice Gableman was probing at, and see whether I can respond to the same question. As I heard his question, in two instances he referred to the voluntary nature of the selection process by the petitioner or the plaintiff. I think the word he used, not allowed to pick, as I recall the question. And in that question, and by the way, in my view, this is a plain meaning case for the court. It can be handled as a matter of law, and I believe that the interpretation that I'm going to suggest to the court is correct. That in and of itself should end the petition. Just as a side comment, since the court has taken its time to look at this issue, and it's a fairly sophisticated issue, my request would be that if it feels able, that it does decide this issue as a matter of judicial efficiency. Kalal is the case that I think starts the analysis, not for the discretionary writ issue per se, but on the issue of how the court approaches the construction of statutory language. And I know the court doesn't want me to read from the decision, but it does, in my mind, contain a prescription of the analysis, process of analysis, in the court's words, at 271, page 663, Wisconsin 2nd, 663 at 45, paragraph 45. And that process, I think, is crucial because it differentiates the canon of construction that says all words in the same sentence have to have, if the same word is used or different words are used, they have to have meaning, a separate meaning. That's a canon, but all, like all canons, they're subject to other canons. Some of us who are old enough took Willard Hearst's course and know full well that for every canon of construction, you cite another one, and Justice Abrahamson and I have gotten into that little discussion on issues such as what does ideological mean, or what is family? But the point that I'm making here is that those rules have been now reduced, I think, to a prescription of analysis, which is very helpful to the court. Statutory interpretation begins with the language of the statute. If the meaning of the statute is plain, we ordinarily stop the inquiry. But here is the paragraph or the sentence that I would ask the court to reflect on as I then take it through what I consider to be the appropriate analysis of these three statutes. Context is important to meaning. So too is the structure of the statute in which the operative language appears. Therefore, statutory language is interpreted in the context in which it is used, not in isolation, but as part of a whole in relation to the language of surrounding or closely related statutes, and reasonably to avoid absurd or unreasonable results.
Counsel, let's concentrate on that for just a moment. In looking at section 752.21 sub 2, both terms, designated and select, are used in that subsection. Why should we not give them separate meanings?
Because designated is not standing alone, Your Honor, and that is the point I was making by what I just read.
Right. It's not standing alone. It stands in contradistinction to select. So would you agree that we need to give them, because they're different words and they're used in the same sentence, would you agree that we need to give them discrete meanings?
I would agree that the word designated is expressly qualified and interpreted in that same statutory language, and the court must give meaning to the meaning of designated as it appears in context of both statutes. The word designated appears in both 801.53a and 752.21, but it also appears in the wholeness of the phrase designated by the plaintiff. Mm-hmm. Both phrases appear identically. And that means that meaning has to have some by the plaintiff is tacked on to designated, and it must be given its meaning and context. And what is the context? In 801.503a, the statute goes on to expressly state, unless another venue is specifically authorized by law. We also know that designated by the plaintiff has to be defined the same way in this these two statutes were which were enacted by the same act at the same time in 2011.
I think we need to bring Chapter 227 into the analysis. I'm going to interrupt you, but I do want you to continue on the path. But I wanted to bring something to your attention to consider as you're sure. speaking to us with your construction. If I start with Chapter 227, which was very operative under the facts of this case, because the trial court judge, in fact, did determine the venue using the language of Chapter 227, because we had, of course, two petitions filed in separate jurisdictions. If I go back to Section 80150, shall be venued in the county designated by the plaintiff, and then we bring back into the conversation Chapter 752, which speaks to a judgment or order appealed from an action venued in a county designated by the plaintiff. In fact, Dane County was designated by the plaintiff, and it was also determined to be the venue by the trial court judge. So we have in tandem a determination of venue by the trial court judge that coincides and is the same as the venue designated by a plaintiff. When we come back to 752, don't we in fact have a judgment appealed from an action venued in a county designated by the plaintiff, which then entitles the state in this case to select the Court of Appeals district?
And at the risk of piling on, but I'm not trying to, the next part of that is going to be 80152 talks about a circuit court's ability to change venue. Where is the statute that talks about the Court of Appeals' authority to do so?
Now, you have a stack of questions. Let's counsel answer some of the questions before we give them some more.
Okay? Well, hang on a second, because I think I was getting close, perhaps, to you answering my question. So if we could hold those questions until you tell me why we are to give the same meaning, according to you, to select and designate.
The same phrase, which is not a word standalone, but designated by the plaintiff, is the meaning that I am saying should hold true for both, and that designated by the plaintiff has a further qualifier.
All right, so are you saying that are you conceding that there's a difference between select and designate?
There can be, and there is here because the phrase here attaches, unless how does it go? Unless another venue is specifically authorized by law, because that applies here, then it has a different meaning, and by that I mean the plaintiff. Whether or not he or she or it wanted to make a choice, had no choice to make. It was specified by law. And there are some instances where it's going to be a forced change. That is to say, I don't want to go to Kewaunee County, and some simply by order of the court. But
because I want you to get to their questions as well. So your position is that designate requires the plaintiff have a choice.
Yes.
Okay. And so your position is that designate and select, as used in 752.21, mean the same thing. You have a choice.
Yes, in that case. It's not a tautology that I'm dealing with, but it's a very difficult argument.
Yes, it is.
The difficulty is that the words are not unqualified in the sense of designated. Designated has a specific qualified meaning that limits its meaning. On occasion, it can mean the same thing
as
choice.
By the plaintiff, it's just saying who's designating, right? That doesn't qualify the meaning of the term designate.
I'm sorry, Justice.
You're saying that designated by the plaintiff restricts the meaning of designate, but by the plaintiff just indicates who's doing the designating, right? That doesn't actually limit
what
designate means.
That's where unless hits. The plaintiff cannot designate under the fullness of this. He can in a technical sense. I can do put a county on and say that, but it's going to get moved by law to the county it belongs in under 227. That's just the way the statute functions. That's the unless. That's how it functions, in fact. And in those instances where the petitioner plaintiff does not have a choice because the law functions to eliminate the choice, whether or not he attempted or she attempted to exercise it, is where the statute differentiates and it becomes no longer parity in the sense of the appellate statute, because in the appellate statute, the loser gets the choice, but only in a situation, I would argue, where the plaintiff or the petitioner had the choice in the first instance.
But you concede that you could read designate as simply, here's what the plaintiff says is the county for venue, right? You could read it that
you
way.
You could read it that way, but I don't think it's a plain meaning.
And then your position is we must read that as designate means a choice, and in this case, there's no choice, and therefore it's not designated by the plaintiff.
And I think, Justice Kelly, you've more or less characterized what the Fourth District said in the second opinion. I mean, the word wasn't choice, but it was, I forgot what the word was, but it said to the same effect. And yes, that was the analysis, and I believe it's the correct analysis when the statutes are read. I do not believe it's a simplistic word-on-word analysis because you read the whole of the phrase that word is attached to, designated, and then you read the qualifier that relates specifically to designated by the plaintiff, and you look at the past statute that had only Dane County, and my understanding is that the unless, et cetera, was interpreted as I suggested be interpreted in prior cases that relates to the prior statute, not to this one. So the bottom line that I would say to the court is that the analysis that Kalal suggests, the in-context full analysis, takes you past a word-on-word comparison, which I think is not only simplistic, but doesn't fit this statute or the structure of these two statutes read together or, frankly, the fundamental issue of reasonableness of interpretation and parity as between rights. And by that, I mean the rights to select. If the right to select is illusory or driven by law or there is no such right after you read the fullness of the phrase, then I suggest it is no. There is no right to designate in the sense of the statutes in question.
Did the legislature choose its words poorly, do you think?
It's above my pay grade to try to redraft legislation. It could have been
ours
clearer.
Too.
It could have been clearer, but I think it's clear enough, and that's why I insist on plain meaning. I think it's clear enough under the analytical tools that Kalal gives us in reading statutes together and reading the whole of them and reading them in the context of how the system works. And if a system is skewed to permit one party to have a choice where the other one didn't, then I don't think that's reasonable or even good policy. So I suggest to the court that the reading that I am attempting to articulate, maybe inartfully, is the reading that this court should adopt as a matter of the result issue and the reasonableness of the issue and the parity that is obtained by it.
Counsel, why would it be unreasonable that the appellant would get to select, would have a variety of appellate venues from which to select when there was only one available to the plaintiff? Why would that be an equitable or bad policy?
No, because I think that the concept is if you get to choose your trial court, I get to choose my appellate court. I'm not sure, honestly, that this doesn't amount to a can of beans because my own view of being a lawyer in this state for 47 years is the courts are going to give you a fair shake wherever you are. So I'm not sure exactly what this is all about, but the truth of the matter is that I think there is a difference, at least to articulate, and it's a matter maybe of how you feel about it.
Right. So so is there anything that we can find in the language of the statute that says that the policy is the appellant gets to choose from a variety of venues only when the plaintiff also has an opportunity to choose from a variety of venues?
Justice Kelly, it follows from the analysis that I made. My analysis essentially interprets the statute to require parity, to require the choice that Justice Gableman was hypothesizing. Okay. And that's the way I think it should be interpreted.
Yeah. Counsel, we had a couple of questions from Justice Ziegler and Justice Rebecca Bradley, and his yellow light is on. So if you could redirect your focus to those justices, that would be helpful.
And to help remind, and I'll be much quicker with my question, here under these facts, the petitioner, in fact, got the choice of venue. It was validated, if you will, by the trial court judge. So if we look at the case narrowly, if we decide this case narrowly, here the petitioner did get its choice of venue.
Yes, you could escape the interpretation by looking at it that way, but I there's a mischief in making designation just an artificial act. For example, let's assume that a petitioner in 227 thinks that for some reason they would like to avoid the Second District Court of Appeals. And as a result, what they do in their petition is to name as venue, file it in Waukesha County, even though they know that as a matter of law it's going to get shipped to Dane County under 227. If the sole issue here is, well, I designated Waukesha, right? And that controls, then the state has no choice that it can make under that hypothesis. Can't that is to say it can't go to the second district. So I don't think the court wants to have an artificial definition of designation. It should have a substantive one where it means something to designate, that it's your choice to designate. It's not just a game we're playing as a matter of venue and forum selection.
Justice Ziegler, if you would ask, do you remember your question?
I do. 801-52 endows the circuit court with the ability to change venue. Where is the authority for the Court of Appeals to do so?
The Court of Appeals to change venue? Honestly, again, that's above my grade as well.
Fair enough. I just thought if there was
I guess
statute,
the answer
is
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Is that really the question, an answer? I mean, she's talking about change of venue. She's not talking about transferring of judges from one district to the other.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if you heard
I'm frankly, as I scramble these issues up, I sometimes don't clearly answer them. Mm-hmm. I apologize to the court.
Well, where are you going to find another case? This is another way, I think, of asking what you're saying. Or authority in the Constitution or in the statutes that a particular district of the Court of Appeals can just say, you're in the wrong district. You filed a notice of appeal to the District 2, which is what happened here. But that's not right. We're taking it.
Well, I've had districts.
That's the issue. Can they do that here?
If you're asking for what I do know, I do know that I can't file in District 4 for a long time. And that's because I happen to be the treasurer and two of the judges' campaigns. So I'm going to District 2 whether I like it or not.
Well, but that raises another issue about recusal, which is the same kind of argument in when the court refused to take on the recusal petition that you make, which is that judges are supposed to apply the facts and law. All of us, we have the same obligation under the Code of Judicial Conduct and under our general concept of what justice is. And you don't change the law just because a judge changes. Therefore, and this goes to the question of harmless error that has been asked, that if you've got qualified judges that don't have to recuse themselves, it doesn't matter who the judges are. And there could be the elected judges from Waukesha County. It could be reserve judges. It could be judges from other districts of the Court of Appeals. That's the way the system works. That's the way it's been done since 1978 when the Constitution was amended to adopt and enforce a Court of Appeals. And that's your argument. I think it's on page 5. Of your brief where you say, even assuming arguendo that DNR had a statutory right to switch venue, in quotes, from District 4 to District 2, there is no cognizable harm unless DNR suggests that the switch could be outcome determinative. And that goes to a question you asked about harmless error.
Yeah, I'm
a
sure
suggestion
I'm
that
sure
is
he
offensive.
Agrees with his statement in his
I
brief.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
That's right. And you did. Now we'd like to hear from Attorney Greer. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Chief Justice Rogensack and members of the Supreme Court. My name is Sarah Gears, and I represent Linda Cochart et al., who I'll refer to collectively as Cochart, and I'm also arguing on behalf of Clean Wisconsin. I'll take just a few minutes of the Court's time to highlight the practical implications of the DNR's interpretation of the general venue statutes, 80150 sub 3A and 75221.
Let me just, before you go too far down that line, I just want to follow up a little bit on what my colleague was just discussing with Mr. Skilton. You know, we've spent a lot of time deciding substitution statutes. And, I mean, if it all boils down to every judge is fair, so it doesn't really matter who hears your case, should we in this case overrule that case law that even I think this past term or two we've decided? What do you think?
Your Honor, overrule which case law?
Well, we've decided cases where judges didn't properly grant substitution requests. I mean, what difference does it make then?
Correct, Your Honor. I don't think this court needs to overrule its past case law in order to uphold the actions of District 4 and dismiss this petition.
The substitution rules apply to circuit court judges. We're talking about the Court of Appeals here.
True. Another good point, Justice Abramson.
Thank you.
Except if every judge is fair in the Court of Appeals, I mean, you know, why? And it doesn't really matter who hears your appeal, and you shouldn't really have a choice in selecting your Court of Appeals, and that's not what the legislature intended with this statute, then, you know, why wouldn't we say all judges are fair and not worry about any of those things?
Well, Justice Ziegler, to be clear, we didn't have we didn't take issue as a general matter about the state selection of District 2 instead of District 4. It was District 4 that acted on its own to direct the state that it had filed in the wrong district.
Why do you think they were right?
Your Honor, for the reasons that Attorney Skilton stated, I think the statutes are clear. This has been consistent with the way that District 4 and practitioners of administrative law have interpreted the way that this specific venue provision works and is distinct from the general venue provisions because the two just do not fit well together. For the reasons that I would like to illustrate, after having only a few years of experience practicing administrative law, I'd like to explain why DNR's interpretation of the general venue statute doesn't necessarily serve the state's interests and also would conflict with the legislative intent and allow appellate venue selection in a wide variety of cases that the legislature did not anticipate. Under the specific venue statute for administrative appeals, 227.53, petitioners challenging agency action must file in their county of residence. The state's position means that the party that loses at the circuit court, whether the state or the petitioner, can select appellate venue. Given the nature of administrative review, which gives deference to state actions, this very often is the petitioner that loses. As counsel for petitioners in many administrative appeals, in many cases, it might be in my client's interest to be able to select the Court of Appeals district that we would prefer, but that's not the law. A recent administrative appeal illustrates the effect of the state's interpretation. In Clean Water Action Council versus Department of Natural Resources, 354 WIS 2D 286, which was cited in our brief, the petitioner was required to petition for review in Brown County Circuit Court. The DNR prevailed at the circuit court level, and Clean Water Action Council appealed to District 3. In contrast, if this court adopts the DNR's argument, then Clean Water Action Council would have been able to select any district of the Court of Appeals except for District 3.
You know, you said something interesting, counsel, that, your clients often have districts, Court of Appeals, that they'd prefer to file, and I wonder what districts those are.
Your Honor, I was speaking generally about, just as the state had a preferred district as District 2, that it has now brought this case to the Supreme Court.
But the law that they're operating under says they can pick any district other than the district in which the county lies that the circuit court, or the circuit court lies in. So they had to go out of District 4. But what counties, what districts were you referring to that you say your plaintiffs would prefer?
Your Honor, I agree with what Justice Ziegler stated before, that I'm able to get a fair decision from any district court of appeals.
To answer your question,
in the specific case of Clean Water Action Council versus Department of Natural Resources, for example, my firm, Midwest Environmental Advocates, represented Clean Water Action Council. All the attorneys in that case are based in Madison. And so for that reason, sometimes for the sake of convenience, we might choose District 4 simply because that's where we're all located.
Counsel, do you have any reasons in addition to those given by Mr. Skilton on why we should not give different and discrete meanings to designate and select as used in 752.21?
Your Honor, I think Attorney Skilton stated it well, but I would also highlight that the canon of statutory interpretation that distinct words in a statute have different meanings is only one of many canons of statutory interpretation that this court follows. And there are other issues of context, reading statutes together, that support our interpretation of the general venue provisions 801.50 and 752.21 versus the specific venue provision under Administrative Law 227.53.
All right. So is your argument similarly based on the assumption that designate must necessarily mean that there's more than one county in which the plaintiff could choose to file the complaint?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yep. So is your argument, if I understand it correctly, is your argument premised on the idea that the term designate must necessarily mean that the plaintiff has options on where to file the complaints?
Your Honor, my position in this case is that where a specific venue provision not only controls the options where a petitioner may file, but doesn't give them the right to designate venue at all. Because in this case, as I believe...
And when you say designate, you mean choose.
I believe that the most logical interpretation of that word is choose. In this particular case, the facts in this particular case demonstrate that it was the circuit court judge for Dane County that determined venue.
So then why did the legislature not say choose or select in 752.21 when it's referring to the venue identified by the plaintiff?
Your Honor, just like Attorney Skilton, those legislative decisions are above my pay grade. One point I would like to highlight is to clarify some of the distinct facts of this case.
Before you do that, I'm trying to figure, because if you want us to give, to not give distinct meanings to different words used in the same sentence, I need to find some textual reason for doing that or contextual reason for it that says you must not give this word any meaning other than choose or select. So what is it about the text of 752.21 or 801.50 or 227.53 that tells me I cannot give designate the meaning proposed by the state?
Well, Your Honor, I think that context is provided by the catch-all exception that the state refers to as the off-ramp for 80150 or 75221 that says it shall be venued in the county designated by the plaintiff unless another venue is specifically authorized by law.
Okay.
And that's the language that the state is not giving enough meaning to and that I think this court should focus on rather than focusing on the need for designated and selected to have distinct meanings.
Okay. And is there any other, besides that, is there any other textual or contextual reason that we must not give designate the meaning proposed by the state?
Your Honor, not that's coming to me right now.
I wonder if, since your orange light is on, I could ask you this. And I don't think it's been discussed in oral argument, but it is discussed in your brief at pages 29, as I read your brief. All the emphasis has been that Clean Wisconsin designated the venue. But you're not the only, and you got, and we haven't discussed that either, whether you use plaintiff, which is in some of the statutes, which doesn't cover this case because these aren't plaintiffs, they're petitioners, and that is covered under 227. But I'll let that go for the moment. The point of this is that you got two petitioners. You've got a group of individuals, and you got Clean Wisconsin. And everybody's emphasizing, well, Clean Wisconsin got the choice, therefore DNR should get the choice. What's good for the, which is a phrase often used here in oral argument, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I never know which one is which, but that's another problem. So here, that's by just concentrating only on Clean Wisconsin, we're ignoring the other petitioners. They don't have a choice.
Correct. And my red light is on.
Yes, if you can answer briefly.
Yes. Thank you, Chief Justice. Justice Abramson, you make an important point that I really wanted to highlight on behalf of my clients, which is that the Cochart petitioners who brought the underlying administrative action that's the subject of this appeal were required to file in Kewaunee County, did file, and thus, under the state's interpretation, designate Kewaunee County,
right.
Agreed that the actions could be consolidated and brought in Dane for the reason I stated to Justice Gableman that all attorneys were located in Dane County. But the circuit court ultimately determined venue to be in Dane County. So under no reasonable interpretation of these facts, could the Cochart petitioners have designated Dane County?
And they didn't have a choice.
Correct, Your Honor.
They could argue to the circuit court what the circuit court should choose.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
They stipulated to it, though, didn't they?
Chief Justice?
Yes, you may answer the question. The red light is on, so we're going to give extra time now to the other side because it really isn't fair to have the court continue beyond what was allocated for one side of the argument. Please answer.
And I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Your client stipulated to the designated venue of Dane County, didn't they?
Correct, for the reasons of convenience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal, please, and you can add 3 minutes onto your time, if you'll do that for me, please.
May it please the Court, I'd like to begin with the Kalal decision as instructed. So in paragraph 24 of Kalal, Justice Sykes, writing for the Court, says, the supervisory writ, however, serves a narrow function to provide for the direct control of lower courts, judges, and other judicial officers, and this is the important language, who fail to fulfill non-discretionary duties, causing harm that cannot be remedied through the appellate review process. Now, the non-discretionary duty has to be something more specific than just failure to follow the law. And the clause in the case did not really describe the specific duty. Here we have described the specific duty, and that's to respect our appellate venue selection rights under 752.21.2. So as I said in my opening,
isn't that just another way of saying a plain duty to correctly apply the law as set forth in the statutes upon which you rely?
I think.
And that's the very thing that Kalal says, hey, no deal.
I don't think that is the same. I think Kalal is saying you cannot just say to the court, this judge has to apply the law. You have to have a specific duty. And here, the plaintiffs there did not provide the specific duty. Here we have, we've said 752.21 sub 2 gives us, DNR, the right to select appellate venue. District 4 violated our rights by sua sponte removing the case from District 2's docket and placing it on its own. So as I said in my opening, my friend's position is incorrect for a few reasons. One, designated and selected must have different meanings because they appear in the same sentence in 752.21 sub 2. So this is just a canon of construction, but it's a very powerful canon here, and I think it's case determinative. Two, they misunderstood the purpose of these statutes. Three, their interpretation makes the express exceptions in 801.50 superfluous because they read the unless clause as another independent source of exceptions. But those two express exceptions would fit into their interpretation of the unless clause, so there would be no reason for the legislature to specifically exempt them in the first place. And four, I didn't actually get this in my opening, the phrase another venue, it only has a logical meaning if a venue is already designated. So in the unless clause, in order for a case to be venued in another venue, there must have been a designated venue in the first place. So beyond that, I have 3 points. My friends,
I thought you said that the plaintiff had designated, that is, Clean Wisconsin had designated a venue.
Yes, I agree. What I'm saying is...
That's a very strained reading of another.
No, I'm sorry. What I'm saying is, in 801.53a, there's a clause that begins unless, and it says the action shall be venued in the county designated by the plaintiff unless another venue is specifically authorized by law.
And they argue that the unless otherwise provided is the one that the last sentence that says that the circuit court determines the venue.
So as I read their arguments, I read their briefs, they are saying the clause unless another venue is specifically authorized by law means when other venue provisions apply, they provide another venue. But in order to have another venue, you need to have a first venue that we're talking about, and that venue we're talking about is the designated venue. Therefore, their meaning of the unless clause cannot possibly be true. So my friends say that this is a plain meaning case, and we agree. And they also agree that judicial economy favors a decision by the court here. We also agree to that. And then further, this case impacts many cases that go through the circuit courts and the courts of appeals. And so even in Kalal, where Justice Sykes writing for the court said that the plain duty element had not been met, the court nonetheless decided the statutory interpretation question and then laid down very important groundworks for this court's statutory interpretation jurisprudence. The court can do that here if it finds any of the elements unsatisfactory. Second.
Counsel. I want to get back to plain duty. And I want to call your attention to a case that you cited, State X Rel Unnamed Petitioner versus Peterson at 363 West 2nd at page 66. The court talks about the Kalal. And it says, the obligation of a judge to correctly find facts and apply the law is not the type of plain legal duty contemplated by a supervisory writ procedure, as it would extend supervisory jurisdiction to a virtually unlimited range of decisions involving the finding of facts and application of law. Isn't that what you're doing in this case?
No, that's not what we're doing in this case. I think the line that Kalal is drawing in plain duty is between the general duty for judges to find facts correctly and apply the law, and then a specific indication of a specific provision of law, a specific legal question that you can point to and say, because the judge did this thing, they violated a mandatory provision of the law. And we've done that here by identifying section 752.21 sub 2. So my friends also say that our interpretation skews to favor one party, but they also correctly identified the party that is skewed in favor is their private litigants, and that's certainly the state's prerogative to create a venue selection framework that favors private litigants vis-a-vis the government. Now, whether or not that will change depending on deference doctrines has remained to be seen, but the legislature created this structure thinking that deference doctrines would remain. So to the extent that favoring one litigant over the other is a concern for the court, that concern favors my friends on the other side, is against perhaps the government. So I think I might disagree on that.
I wonder what your response is to your friend, Mr. Skilton, when he argues that there must be some kind of parity in choice, that the statute, that the language of the statute by using the word chooses versus designate implies that, well, the plaintiff gets to choose the circuit court, so therefore the appellant gets to choose the district. What's your response to that?
My response is, one, they use the words designated and selected. Designated has two permissible meanings. It could mean indicated or specified, as we say. It could also have a choose interpretation. Because of 752.21.2, we know which meaning is correct. It's the indicate or specify. So there is no concept of choice in the circuit court. It's a concept of indication or specification. My second point on this is that it is the plaintiff who designates and the appellant who selects. That very well may be the same party, and because the state often wins cases against it, it often is the same party. So just, it is manifestly not the purpose of this
statute.
Well,
I wonder, you were discussing Kalal, and I kind of expected you to run to a Kalal plain language analysis to say it doesn't appear that there's any such parity required by the plain language unless you see it differently.
I do not see it differently. I agree
and
with that analysis.
And even though, if I may be so bold, what I hear you saying is even though choices may be circumscribed, certainly there has to be a designation somewhere.
Yes, that's exactly right. So my final point is that the legislature gave appellants the right to select appellate venue in the first instance in cases like this and in positions like DNR has found itself in. Any appeal after a final judgment in the wrong district can't remedy that right. So that's why a supervisory writ is required to remedy this violation. And if there are no further questions, I'd be happy to rest on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for a very interesting case and excellent case. We have enjoyed them all, as you can see. It's an interesting question and one that we will enjoy chewing on among the seven of us. We're going to take a brief recess now so other people can get set up for the second case of the day. We are adjourned.